Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, I've just been up in Madison County, north of Asheville. It's up along the Tennessee border. And the reason that I was there is because of Terry Roberts, our friend and neighbor here in Chapel Hill, who is the author of a book that's set in Madison County called A Short Time to Stay Here. This is a story set during the First World War times and talks, it's during the context of the internment of a couple of thousand Germans, civilians mainly, but not altogether. And they were interned in a resort hotel in Hot Springs. And Terry Roberts, you grew up in that area. You know the stories, but your book is fiction.
It is fiction. It draws on events that occurred in 1917 and 1918 in the little Madison County town of Hot Springs. I say little, although in that era it was a much bigger spot on the map, figuratively speaking, because there was a grand luxury hotel called the Mountain Park Hotel that had been built in the late 1880s. And because of the worldwide recession that preceded World War I, the owners of the hotel were looking for a different cash flow source, and they worked out a deal with the federal government to build an internment camp around the hotel. All of this is historically documented, well documented, in several different places. And when they did, one of the things that happened is that 2,000 German sailors primarily, and again, as you say, DG, these were almost exclusively non-combatants, were brought to Hot Springs from American ports where their ships were impounded. And so suddenly you had this collision of cultures between these, in some cases, very sophisticated Germans, men who had captained the largest and most sophisticated cruise ships in the world, who spoke numerous languages, who had traveled by definition all over the world, and now they were dropped down to what them must have seemed the middle of nowhere, this little town, resort town, in western North Carolina. And they were face to face with local people, many of whom had never been, say, as far as Asheville, many of whom had never been outside Madison County. And one of the things that intrigued me about this story when I heard about it as a boy, but then of course later read about it as a mature man, is that this collision of culture between these two groups of people must have been extraordinary. And one of the things that seems to have taken place is that it was a friendly collision, if such a thing is possible, meaning that the fact that there was a war going on in Europe, that American boys were coming home in caskets after a fairly short period of time, didn't seem to disturb the sense of community that sprang up between these German interns and the local people who worked in the camp. They worked as cooks. They worked as guards. They grew. There's a famous story about a farmer in Spring Creek who grew almost 100 acres of cabbage because the Germans loved their cabbage in various forms, including sauerkraut. And the idea then is that there was this oasis of cultural exploration, conversation, but largely it was an oasis of peace, despite the fact that the rest of the world was at war. So it's a fascinating little period in North Carolina history, in Western North Carolina history, and to me it seemed the perfect setting for a novel.
Why was this setting perfect for a novel?
I think part of it is there's always this tension to me, in my mind, in Appalachian literature, Southern Appalachian literature, between the external point of view and the internal point of view. There are those folks who grew up here and sing the old songs and mind the old ways and tell the old stories, many of whom don't leave. And on the other hand, there tend to be people who are attracted to Western North Carolina because it's geographically, physically, it's gorgeous, it's beautiful. The weather is generally temperate, even though there are four wonderful seasons. And so there's always, in most of Appalachian literature, there are outsiders who come there. And when they come there, they struggle to deal with the local people, and the local people struggle to deal with them. So part of what intrigued me about this story is that here it was ready-made, this notion of not just outsiders, not tourists, but men, and they were exclusively men, except for their families who came there to stay while they were interned. These men who had seen the whole world, east to west, north to south, and now all of a sudden they were brought here, and you had this enforced collision of outsider and insider, which I think is very intriguing.
So this was on the model of fiction where one of the themes is a stranger comes to town. This is 2,000 strangers come to town.
Exactly. 2,000 strangers come to town. And in fact, Jackie Bergen's great history, nonfiction history of these events, is called The German Invasion of Western North Carolina, kind of tongue-in-cheek. They didn't intend to invade North Carolina, but they were brought here by the federal government. So 2,000 strangers came to town. I love that image. And all of a sudden, they had to deal with the local people, and the local people had to deal with them. The protagonist of the novel, the narrator, is a man named Stephen Robbins. He is based very loosely, and I want to underline very, on a distant relative of mine, a man named Stephen Roberts, who was the manager of the Mountain Park Hotel prior to World War I. But I know very little about Stephen Roberts in actual fact, and so that freed me to create this fictional character named Stephen Robbins, who becomes, by default, the inspector general of the camp. In fact, there's a scene in the novel where he's talking to Hans Reusser, the senior German officer among those interned, and Reusser compares Robbins to the captain of a ship, and they have a conversation, and then he asks Robbins if he's a prison man, a prison guard or warden, and Robbins says, "No, I'm not. I'm a hotel man." And so he views the Germans as his guests. It's a little more complicated than that, though, as you can imagine. At one point later in the novel, when he realizes what he has on his hands, he tells somebody that my job is to protect the Germans from each other, the local people from each other, the Germans from the local people, and the local people from the Germans. So in other words, the social stratification and complexity, and even with the fact that it was largely peaceful, sort of the nascent conflict between all these groups, it becomes his job to mediate, if you will. And so he has his hands full.
Well, we're visiting with Terry Roberts about his new book, A Short Time to Stay Here. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Terry Roberts, who is our current neighbor here in Chapel Hill. He's the director of the National Paideia Center, but he's also the author of a new book called A Short Time to Stay Here. We're talking about that book in the context of 2,000 German internees during World War I up in Hot Springs, North Carolina, which is a tiny town, a resort town in those days with when you try to describe this hotel and what it was and what it meant, you have to think about Pinehurst, or you have to the Virginia big hotels where people go for a luxury vacation. This is what we're talking about, I guess.
Exactly. I think that's right. I think one of the things we forget is that in 1917, the railroad was for most people, I mean, there were automobiles around, but for most people, the railroad was the primary means of transportation once you came inland from the coast. The Germans were brought to Hot Springs on the railroad. Prior to World War I, guests who had come to the Mountain Park Hotel to soak in the medicinal springs had come there by railroad. And in a strange kind of way, D.G., the hotel in Hot Springs itself was not nearly as isolated then as it is now. And the fact that this luxury hotel was there primarily was because there are natural hot springs there, which bubble up both inside and beside the French Broad River. Native Americans, the Cherokee, had been aware of that for generations, and then the early settlers found that out. And this was in an era when people believed that hot mineral springs cured you of everything.
So not only felt good like we think, but it would make you better.
Gout to syphilis, whatever ailed you, it would cure you. And so people would go there from the lowlands of South Carolina, from the Gulf Coast, even from far away as Florida, and spend the summer and soak in the hot springs every day. They would take the baths as one used to say, in England, only this, of course, was circa late 18th, 19th century America. And when they did that, they thought of this as something profound, even something almost spiritual. And so when people say, well, what would be the modern equivalent, the 21st century equivalent, it's almost like a casino on the interstate. In other words, people came there for a reason. And it was relatively easy to get there because of the railroad. And because of that, again, the recession, something we can identify with, of course, in 2012, had caused the constituency of the hotel to fall off in the years prior to World War I. But even so, this was a remarkable place and a remarkable time. And another thing that really interests me about this is that it's a place and time that's been lost to history, meaning there is, as my friends in Raleigh tell me, there's a very nice historical marker beside the two-lane road that tells you there was a German internment camp. But even the local people know very little about the camp, what it was,
it's
what truly went on
there. Three generations back, and the oral traditions have faded away.
That's correct. And in part because, even though I'm convinced a fair number of the Germans remained in the United States after the war, because again, they were non-combatants. They were interned either here or in Georgia through the end of the war. So again, they had every opportunity to stay if they wanted to in many instances, and many of them had families in the U.S. Despite that, there is no local folk history, folklore around the camp other than the fact that it existed. And so to me, it's almost like an island in the sea of history, and it's an unexplored island in a way. And this novel attempts to explore that island.
Well, tell us about your novel and the stories, the story framework, as much as you're willing to introduce it to us.
There's the man who is the proprietor, the inspector general of the camp, is in his late 40s when the novel takes place. He has been married. He married the daughter of the owner of the hotel, a historical figure named James Henry Rumbo. He married one of the Rumbo girls in my fictionalized world. This is where now fiction departs from history.
So there was a Rumbo, and we can go to Hot Springs and find evidence of him, but the daughter and the marriage to your loosely based on your relative, that's all from your imagination.
That's all from my imagination. And Stephen himself, I think, is an interesting character because he's an adult, meaning he's lived long enough to have experienced success in his life. He is a kind of Horatio Alger story in a way. He ran away from home at about age 12. He's largely self-educated. He started out as working in the stables at the Mountain Park Hotel, and now before the war, he's in his mid-40s. He's the manager. But he's lost a child, infant cholera. He is divorced from his wife. He has a failed marriage. And he also is probably an alcoholic, although we don't explore that in great detail. He's a man with some, as one person even said, self-hatred. And that seems a little extreme to me, but he certainly has self-doubt. He's trying to work all this out, and he's trying to work it out while he's on stage, if you will, as now the inspector general of this huge, sprawling internment camp with 2,000 guests, if you will. So he tells the story, Stephen does, and a second interesting character, I'm going to save Anna Ullman, the love interest, for just a moment, but a second interesting character is a man named Prince Garner, and Prince Garner is based on a historical figure who was there in the late 1800s, early 1900s in Hot Springs. He is a African-American preacher and barber. In fact, he worked on the train before he actually started working at the Mountain Park Hotel as the barber.
One of the things that, Chapel Hill people might feel comfortable in Hot Springs, but they wouldn't, even today, they wouldn't see too many black people there.
No. And in fact, there was a thriving black community in Hot Springs in 1917 that no longer exists. You know, like we can go for a walk around town. I can show you the building where the African American school was. I can show you where the historical Prince Garner and his wife Dora are buried in the Rumbo family cemetery up on the mountainside. But now, in large part because the interstate came along and bypassed the town, there is very little employment there now. the African Americans who lived in Hot Springs in the early 20th century left, but not because of the Jim Crow laws and because of racial prejudice. They left because there was almost no employment of the kinds that they were used to, particularly once the hotel was gone. The railroad was no longer the primary means of transportation, and the interstate bypassed the town, so to speak. And so one of the things that happened is that Prince, because he married Rumbaugh's black daughter, half-black daughter, which is a whole other sort of story in and of itself, Stephen and Prince Garner are, in a sense, they married sisters. And so they're brothers-in-law, if you will. And in fact, they are close friends, you know, after the rest of the family has sort of fallen away. And they are, no pun intended, the black sheep of the family, both. And so they become good friends. And their relationship, I think, runs throughout the novel and gives a kind of flavor to the book that it might not have otherwise. And there is a love interest. There is an imaginary character, a fictional character named Anna Ullman, who comes down from New York, who is a documentary photographer.
She's history or she's fiction?
She's fiction, but she's based loosely on a woman named Doris Ullman, who was a documentary photographer from New York, who was in the area in the 1930s, who was a famous, she took a lot of folk photographs, we would call them.
I see. So she's based on someone, but there was not a photographer. Well, or was there? Seems like there were some pictures of the camp that surfaced that caused some problems.
There were two photographers. One was German, and in fact, his photographs, Adolf Thurbach, he was a interned German who brought his camera along for the ride. His photographs were later discovered in an album in a New England city. For some reason, I'm thinking it was New York. The captions were handwritten in German. This is years after World War I. And somebody finally figured out, by doing a little bit of amateur historical research, that this was probably from that internment camp. And they sent that album full of photographs to the Madison County Library, where it resides today. You can go to Marshall, visit the Madison County Library, and open up the original album with Thurbach's handwritten notes beside the photographs. Glad to say that those photographs are online now at iBiblio.com. If you visit the novel's website, there is a link on the last page to the site where you can go see those photographs. There were also photographs taken by local mountain people. One of the men who was the chaplain of the Dorland Bell School in Hot Springs, in fact, was also an amateur photographer, and we think a lot of the photographs that we have of the camp, the guards, and some of those photographs were taken by him. But the female photographer, Anna Ullman, is a fictional creation. She arrives at the camp. She is fleeing a disastrous marriage in New York City to a Freudian analyst, which is very accurate to the time period. She had been, I think a good way to put it, is the victim of depth psychology by her husband.
And I thought this was sending a message somehow of your encounter with psychiatry or psychiatrist. And
I'm laughing because I believe in psychotherapy. I just don't believe in the kind that Anna suffered from.
Okay.
But
anyway,
so she comes south and discovers not the genial old Major Rumbaugh that she had expected to discover, the friend of her father's, but she finds Stephen Robbins. And in the beginning, they have a pretty darn antagonistic relationship. They rub each other the wrong way from the beginning. And part of the reason, in my mind, is this sort of social and cultural difference. She has traveled widely. She's very sophisticated. She has a college degree. She has read not just the same novels that Stephen has read, but she read them in French or she read them in German. And so she's a different animal than anything he's seen before, even though he has, of course, seen the patrons of the hotel. And in the beginning, they neither one know what to do with the other, and it takes them some time to get used to each other. Eventually, they do, after some fireworks, I guess. And eventually, they do fall in love. I will say that much. I don't want to say too much about their relationship, but one of the things they do is each helps the other understand himself or herself.
Now, Terry, is this the main? This is your novel set in Hot Springs in 1917, and is this love interest? Is it a romantic novel? Is that what it is? Is this the main theme? I guess this relationship between the two.
Yeah, I don't know. I would say it a little differently. My son, who was taking AP Literature when I was working on this novel, asked me one day in a fit of advanced placement literature. I guess he's going to grow up and become an interviewer, DG, like you. He said, "So what's the main theme?"
And then, well, that was,
what's the main theme?
He
of this
just
novel?
Was more direct than
he
I am.
He cut straight to the chase. And I said, "Well, Henry, the main theme is imprisonment and escape." And to be honest, at that moment, I said it right off the top of my head. You know, just one of those things where it just sort of came to me. And I think in both on the personal level, in terms of the love story between Stephen and Anna and how that plays out over the course of the novel, both of them are, in a sense, imprisoned by the past, by past relationships. And Anna's case, she's extremely fearful of her husband, even though he's hundreds of miles away in New York City. They are, in some sense, culturally imprisoned, meaning as are we all, they were the product of their education, of their culture, of their family, of their background, and in some sense are both attracted to the idea of escape from that. But all of that, of course, takes place in the setting of this giant sprawling internment camp, which is surrounded by, in the fictional version, a 10-foot-high barbed wire fence. In actual fact, historically, I think it was maybe 4 feet high. But in the novel, it's much higher and much more threatening in a way, much more difficult to get in and out of this camp. And so on a number of levels, this is a book about, I think, for human beings, about the kinds of imprisonment we choose, the kinds of imprisonment that we inherit, the kinds of imprisonment that is thrust upon us involuntarily, and then what it means to try to escape from those, from our past, from our history, from our background. And in that way, I think this is a very adult novel. In other words, you know, when occasionally I'll say this is a book for adults, and people think I mean it's X-rated, and I don't. For better or worse.
The themes are better understood when you've been through some of these things.
That's right. When you've lived long enough to understand some of these themes.
Well, we're visiting with Terry Roberts about his new book, A Short Time to Stay Here, and he and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Terry Roberts. We're talking about his book, set in Hot Springs, North Carolina, up in Madison County, north of Asheville. Pretty remote now. Terry said it wasn't that remote back then because they had a railroad, and they also, it was cosmopolitan, they had 2,000 German internees in the hotel at Hot Springs. And we're talking about A Short Time to Stay Here, which is Terry's new book. Now, you know, you answered your son's question about what the theme of the book was, but you didn't really answer the question about whether it was basically a love story. And so let's mm-hmm. move on to the next question: is that your hero, your lead character, Stephen Robbins, has an evil cousin.
Yes, he
named
does.
Roy Robbins.
Yeah.
And where did he come from, and what role does he play in your book, and why you got such a bad guy in there?
Such a bad guy. Every story needs an antagonist. I've had that conversation in the past few days. But more to come about Roy in a second. You know, I'm going to circle back around to the question of, is it a love story? I would say it's a love story and a war story, because in some sense, it seems to me, those two big ideas are intertwined. Sort of not love and death, although there's that aspect of this book. There's a lot of death in this book because, again, it's a war story. Even though we're not on the front lines, a number of people die during the course of the book, including some characters we come very close to. So I think it's a kind of balance, an interwoven notion of love and war. And so to say that it's a love story and a war story, or it's a war story and a love story, I think is accurate because it puts those two feelings, those two themes in counterpoise with each other.
The same themes as in Hemingway's A Farewell to Arms.
I would like to think so. Yeah. that's Fast Company, but I would like to think that's right. Yeah, and they go well together in a sense because they live in juxtaposition. One of Faulkner's favorite words was juxtaposition. Well, these two ideas, these two feelings, these two themes in human experience live in juxtaposition, I think.
All right. Well, then, what role does the evil sheriff play?
Where does Roy come in? Roy Robbins I liked writing about Roy in a way. There is a photograph by Doris Ullman of a mountain preacher taken in the 30s. I don't remember the man's name, thankfully, because if I did, I of course would say it. I sort of based in a way Roy's physical presence on that photograph by Doris Ullman. Because he's a very, as Stephen says at one point, he looks like milk, but trust me, he's made of sin. And Roy is a sexual predator, what we now would call a sexual predator. That phrase wasn't current in 1917, I don't think. He's somewhat sadistic. He has been Stephen's antagonist really since they were kids. In other words, they fought as boys, physically fought, and they've grown up antipathy, a real deeply bred antipathy. One of the things that concerned me in writing the book, and I deal with this later on, is it's possible to view Stephen's relationship with Roy, because they are first cousins, as kind of stereotypically Southern. It's them, the Hatfields and the McCoys, a feudin' and them thar heels kind of thing. And for me, that was never the case. In other words, A, they were both very real in my imagination, and Stephen talks to Anna about that stereotype late in the book when he's telling her. But there is a mysterious event that's happened in their past, something that Stephen had done unknowingly once he became the manager of the Mountain Park Hotel. It's a violent event, and it gives, as Stephen says in Chapter 1, Roy Robbins a very real and very personal reason to hate me. Well, I won't say what that event is here. I'd like to leave a few reasons to read the novel, but their lives are bound up together, and they are enough alike, I think, both in blood and genetics and in background, so that they represent a very real threat to each other, if that makes sense. But they are radically different in the sense that Stephen is a romantic, for one thing, capital R, meaning he believes in the innate goodness of the human race, despite all the evidence to the contrary. He believes in simple human kindness, he says at one point later in the book, and in fact even thinks it's his job to treat the German interns with human kindness. There is an almost New Testament Christianity theme there that's reflected in one of the other characters, Julius Christopher, that is the antithesis, I think, to Roy, and Roy's sort of Old Testament violence and viciousness. And I guess what I would say in terms of the plot is that Roy comes to pay a visit late in the novel, as we sort of think he will all the way along, or at least as Stephen thinks he will. And so the threat is realized late in the book.
Well, you've got the characters, you've got the setting, and what do you do for a story? Do you have a murder mystery? Do you have a problem to solve? What were you thinking about when you put this book together? Because a lot of it is, I don't want to say it's autobiographical, but it is coming to terms with a place that is mm-hmm. important to you and yeah. at a time that interests you. And so the challenge in that environment where you're so interested in those things is to come up with a story that drives it. And how did you do that?
I think the story was the last piece to fall into place as I was writing the book. Meaning, I knew who the characters were. I knew what the setting was. I knew that part of what was going to happen is, pardon me, that there was going to play out over the course of the book several different threats to the peaceful, what Stephen at one point calls the fabric of community that was so carefully knit together by himself and by others, is torn at several different places. It's torn by an attempt on the part of some of the Germans to do violence to some of the other Germans, a deliberate, planned attempt. Roy is always lurking in the wings, you know, waiting to make another appearance. And so there are threats to this sense of community and the sense of peace. I read John Knowles' A Separate Peace recently, and it occurred to me that there is a sense in which what Stephen and others, Prince Garner, John Sanders, and others of his co-workers are trying to do is create a kind of separate peace, an island of peace in the midst of war. But that's constantly threatened. So I knew all that. I knew the love story was going to work itself out in one way or another. What I didn't know until I was most of the way through at least the first draft is what was going to happen ultimately, if you will, is kind of the climax of the plot of the story, which it involves Roy, and Roy's coming to pay a call on the internment camp. So there's that. I also didn't know until the last chapter how the love story would resolve itself. Mm. One of the things that was, if kind listener, if you do read the novel, when you get to the last chapter, you'll discover that it's set in New York City for reasons that are driven by the plot and driven by the characters. It's where Anna's from, for one thing. And so that last domino, which is the resolution of the love story, for it to fall, I was really there. I was right up to writing that chapter before I knew for certain how that would play out. One of the things I didn't know is I wanted it to be realistic psychologically, emotionally, and for the reader. And I also wanted it to be faithful to who these people were at this point, you know, who they had become, particularly Stephen and Anna. Prince also, but as a kind of secondary character. And so all of this was, I think, at play. And I guess what I would say, DG, is that I enjoyed that rather than being made uncomfortable by it. In other words, there was a sense, this is going to sound a little cutesy, but almost, you hear writers say sometimes, well, I had to write the book in order to find out how it would end. Well, it felt like that for much of this. I knew in a sense where we were going, wasn't always sure how we were going to get there in terms of the events of the last several chapters of the book. And then I also didn't quite know how that last piece would fall into place. I hope that it fell the right way.
In some respects, it doesn't matter. Because these kinds of relationships between adults who've had struggles in their lives before, mm-hmm. And encounter a new love interest, sometimes they turn out really well, and sometimes there's another disaster on hand.
Yeah.
But that the working through that relationship, as you do in this novel, is itself something that grabs hold of people who are, experiencing that either directly or through the experiences of friends or family.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're talking to Terry Roberts about his book, A Short Time to Stay Here. Terry Roberts is the director of the National Padea Center here in Chapel Hill, but it's going to move, and so I want to take a break and talk about what that center does and what it will do when it leaves Chapel Hill. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I've been talking to Terry Roberts about his book, A Short Time to Stay Here, and I'd like to keep on talking about the book because it's fantastically interesting. If you joined us late, it's one of the several books that that I've been introduced to in the past few months set in Madison County, North Carolina. I'm all hot for that county. And so Terry Roberts, the National Padilla Center, I can remember 20 years ago or so when, was it Adler? Mortimer mm-hmm. Adler came down to Chapel Hill and excited maybe Bill Friday and others about the new or a different way of learning and the possibility that the university might be the center for the evangelism mm-hmm. or the outreach for the Padilla Center in relationship with the resources here. And so all that came about. You're here in Chapel Hill. You're running it, but it's going to move. Mm-hmm. And why?
Well, the National Padilla Center was founded in 1988, and you were exactly right, DG. It was the brainchild of Bill Friday, then president of the university system, and a philosopher named Mortimer Adler, who had written three books in the early mid-80s called The Padilla Proposal, The Padilla Program, and then Padilla Problems and Possibilities. Padilla is the Greek word for the nurturing of children, and it has a kind of broad affect, meaning it's about a well-rounded adult, his or her emotional, physical, mental, and even spiritual health, and how our society nourishes that health in preparing one generation to take its place in society. And so the idea fundamentally, the way it's played out over the last 25 years, is that it has a lot to do with what we would think of as a liberal arts education in K-12, meaning it's what happens in a liberal arts college, kindergarten through 12th grade, particularly with emphasis on literacy, and literacy meaning reading, speaking and listening, and writing.
Not just reading.
Not just reading, but literacy, a broader notion of literacy, the kind of literacy that is, you might even call it critical literacy, that is directly the result of and emblematic of critical thinking, meaning if somebody's reading, speaking and listening, and writing at a high level, that implies, of course, that they're thinking critically about the material, whatever that is. So that's our work. That's what we do. And even ironically, even though we have been based in a state university, we do that work all over the country and in a few foreign countries, notably the Philippines, Sweden, and Chile in the last 10 years. And so one of the reasons we have negotiated with the university, striking out on our own, if you will, is that our mission in many ways, even though it resonates with that of the university, is much broader than just the state of North Carolina. We literally work all over the country and in some cases in a few foreign countries. The other thing is, I think the best way to view the National Padilla Center is as a spinoff that has been nurtured by the university. Now, we're not a grand spinoff, a huge software company, for instance, not to name any names, but on a much smaller scale, our intellectual property, if you will, are ideas as opposed to computer software, that kind of thing. And the other thing is that historically, since the first 2 years, we've never had any state funding. In other words, we've always existed based on fee-for-service work that we do with schools and school systems and on grant funding from a few foundations. And so in the last few years, we've reached the point where it seemed to us and to Bill Friday before he died that it was time for the center to strike out on its own and to separate from the university, even though Bill, obviously, like us, loved the University of North Carolina. So this is a very friendly parting of the ways. It's done with the collaboration and the help of university officials and university administrators. And so far, and our goal is to create an independent nonprofit National Padilla Center that will have its home base in Asheville, North Carolina. The connection, of course, being that lets me get a little closer back home. But also, we've been welcomed by open arms by the nonprofit community in Asheville. There are partnerships that you can't describe it any other way except low-hanging fruit. There's a lot of things out there for us to do. It's just a matter of finding time for us to do it. And so we look forward, starting in January 2013, to the second quarter century of the National Padilla Center in a new home, in a new organization. but still continuing the work that Bill Friedemy and Mortimer Adler imagined back in the late 80s. And so this is a continuation of the mission, only in a slightly different guise. And for all those out there, educators who happen to be listening, you'll be able to find us on Page Avenue, Asheville, North Carolina, January 2013. And we plan to keep right on doing the same work we've been doing for the last 20 years for as long as there is need. And quite honestly, we expect that to be quite a long time.
Well, Terry Roberts, thanks for coming to visit, telling us about your book, A Short Time to Stay Here, and about your work at the National Padilla Center. And we wish you well up there in Asheville, but we will miss you.
Thank you so much, DG. It was truly a pleasure.
And thanks to you for listening. This has been Who's Talking with D.G. Martin, and I'll be back here before you know it.